here, Harry looked around. He was surrounded by wind and rain. It might have been 5 degrees Celsius, if he was lucky. He'd already had a warming charm cast on himself just from being outside in February, but it wasn't standing up to the driving cold droplets. Worse than snow, the rain soaked into every exposed surface. The cloak of invisibility turned all of you invisible, but it didn't cover all of you, and that meant it didn't protect all of you from rain. Harry's face was exposed to the full force of the driven water, and it was driving straight into his neck and soaking down into his shirt. Also, the sleeves of his robes and the cuffs of his pants and his shoes. The water took every bit of cloth as an avenue to sneak in.
"This way," said the polyjuiced voice, and a spark of green light lit up in front of Harry's broomstick, and then darted away in a direction that seemed to Harry like every other direction. Through the blinding rain, Harry followed. He lost it sometimes, that small green spark, and each time he did, Harry called out and the spark would reappear in front of him a few seconds later. When Harry had caught the trick of following the spark, it accelerated, and Harry kicked the broomstick into high gear and followed. The rain whipped him harder, feeling like Harry imagined it must feel to get a faceful of shotgun pellets, but his glasses stayed clear and protected his eyes. It was only a few minutes later, at the broomstick's full speed, that Harry caught a glimpse of a huge shadow through the rain, towering far across the waters, and felt a distant, hollow echo of emptiness radiating from where death waited, washing over Harry's mind and parting around it, like a wave breaking on stone. Harry knew his enemy this time, and his will was steel, and all of the light.
"I can already feel the Dementors,"
said the gravelly voice of the polyjuiced Professor Quirrell.
"I did not expect that. Not this soon."
"Think of the stars,"
Harry said over a distant rumble of thunder.
"Don't allow any anger in you. Nothing negative. Just think of the stars, what it feels like to forget yourself and fall bodilessly through space. Hold to that thought like an occlumency barrier across your entire mind. The Dementors will have some trouble reaching past that."
There was silence for a moment. Then,
"Interesting."
The green spark lifted, and Harry inclined his broomstick slightly upward to follow, even as it steered them into a fog bank, a cloud hovering low on the waters. Soon they were hovering above the slightly oblique of the huge three-sided metal building, as it loomed far below. The triangle of steel was hollow, not solid. It was a building of three thick, solid walls and no centre. The auras on guard roomed in the top level and southern side of the building, Professor Quirrell had said, protected by their Patronus charms. The legal entrance into Azkaban was on the roof of the southwest corner of the building, which the two of them wouldn't use, of course. Instead, they would use a corridor that ran directly beneath the northern corner of the building. Professor Quirrell would go down first and puncture a hole in the roof and its wards right at the northern tip, leaving behind an illusion to cover the gap. The prisoners were kept in the side of the building in levels corresponding to their crimes. And, at the bottom, in the uttermost centre and depth of Azkaban, lay a nest of more than 100 Dementors. loads of dirt were occasionally dropped in to keep up the level, as the matter directly exposed to the Dementors broke down into mud and nothingness.
"One minute," said the rough voice. "Follow me at speed, and pass through with care."
"Got it,"
Harry said lowly. The spark winked out, and Harry began to count.
1 1,000, 2 1,000, 3 1,000, 60 1,000.
And Harry dived, the wind shrieking around him as he dived, down toward the vast metal structure, down toward where he could feel the shadows of death waiting for him, draining light and radiating emptiness as the metal structure grew larger and larger. Plain and featureless loomed the vast grey shape, but for a single raised box-like structure in the southwest corner. The north corner was simply blank, Professor Quirrell's hole undetectable. Harry pulled up sharply as he approached the north corner, giving himself more safety margin than he would have bothered with in flying classes, but not too much. As soon as he'd come to a halt, he began to slowly lower his broomstick again, toward what looked like the solid roof of the tip of the north corner. Descending through the illusory roof, while invisible, was a strange experience. And then Harry found himself in a metal corridor, lighted with a dim orange light, which, Harry realized after a startled glance, was coming from an old-fashioned, mantled gas lamp. For magic would fail, be drained away after a time, in the presence of Dementors. Harry dismounted his broom. The pull of the emptiness was stronger now, as it parted and flowed around Harry without touching him. They were distant, but they were many, the wounds in the world. Harry could have pointed to them with his eyes closed.
"Cast your Patronus,"
hissed a snake from the floor, looking more discolored than green in the dim orange light. The note of stress came through even in Parseltongue. Harry was surprised. Professor Quirrell had said that Animagi in their Animagus forms were much less vulnerable to Dementors. For the same reason, the Patronuses were animals, Harry assumed. If Professor Quirrell was in this much trouble in his snake form, what had been happening to him while he was in the human form that let him use his magic? Harry's wand was already rising in his hand. This would be the beginning. Even if it was only one person, just one person that he could save from the darkness, even if he wasn't powerful enough yet to teleport all of Azkaban's prisoners to safety and burn the triangular hell down to bedrock. Even so, it was a start. It was a beginning. It was a down payment on everything that Harry meant to accomplish with his life. No more waiting. No more hoping. No more promising. It would all begin here. Here. And now. Harry's wand slashed down to the point at where the Dementors waited far below.
"Expecto Patronum!"
The glowing humanoid figure blazed up into existence. It wasn't the sun-bright thing that it had been before, probably because Harry hadn't quite been able to stop himself from thinking about all the other prisoners in their cells, the ones that he wasn't here to save. It might be for the best, though. Harry would need to keep this Patronus going for a while, and it might be better if it wasn't quite so bright. The Patronus dimmed a little further at that thought, and then further again, as Harry tried to put a little less of his strength into it, until, finally, the brilliant humanoid figure was glowing only slightly brighter than the brightest animal Patronus, and Harry felt that he could dim it no further without risking losing it entirely. And then...
"It is stable,"
Harry hissed, and began feeding his broomstick into his pouch. His wand stayed in his hand, and a slight, sustainable flow from him replaced the slight losses from his Patronus. The snake blurred into the form of a lanky, sallow man, holding Professor Quirrell's wand in one hand and a broomstick in the other. The lanky man staggered as he came back into existence and went to lean against the wall for a moment.
"Well done, if perhaps a trifle slow," murmured the gravelly voice.
Professor Quirrell's dryness was in it, even though it didn't fit the voice, nor did the grave look on the thickly bearded face.
"I cannot feel them at all now."
A moment later, the broomstick went into the man's robes and vanished. Then the man's wand rose and tapped on his head, and with a sound like a cracking eggshell, he disappeared once more. Within the air blossomed a faint green spark, and Harry, still enshrouded in the cloak of invisibility, followed after. If he had been watching from outside, you would have seen nothing but a small green spark drifting through the air and a brilliantly silver humanoid walking after it. They went down, and down, and down, passing gas lamp after gas lamp and the occasional huge metal door, descending into Azkaban within what seemed like utter silence. Professor Quirrell had set up some type of barrier by which he could hear what went on nearby, but no sounds could pass outward, and no sounds could reach Harry. Harry hadn't quite been able to stop his mind from wondering why the silence, or stop his mind from giving the answer. The answer he had already known on some wordless level of anticipation that had prompted him to futilely try not to think about it. Somewhere behind those huge metal doors, people were screaming. The silver humanoid figure wavered, brightening and dimming every time Harry thought about it. Harry had been told to cast a bubblehead charm on himself, to prevent himself from smelling anything. All the enthusiasm and heroism had worn off already, as Harry had known it would. It hadn't taken long, even by his standards. The process had completed itself the very first time they passed one of those metal doors. Every metal door was locked with a huge lock, a lock of simple, unmagical metal that wouldn't have stopped a first-year Hogwarts student if you still had a wand, if you still had your magic, which the prisoners didn't. Those metal doors were not the doors of individual cells, Professor Quirrell had said. Each one opened into a corridor in which there would be a group of cells. Somehow, that helped a little, not thinking that each door corresponded directly to a prisoner who was waiting right behind it. Instead, there might be more than one prisoner, which diminished the emotional impact, just like the study showing that people contributed more when they were told that a given amount of money was required to save one child's life than when told the same total amount was needed to save eight children. Harry was finding it increasingly hard not to think about it, and every time he did, the light of his Patronus fluctuated. They came to the place where the passageway turned left, at the corner of the triangular building. Once again, there were descending metal steps. Another flight of stairs. Once again, they went down. Mere murderers were not put into the lowest of cells. There was always a lower place you could go, an even worse punishment to fear. No matter how low you had already sunk, the government of magical Britain had some threat remaining against you if you did even worse. But Bellatrix Black had been the Death Eater who inspired more fear than anyone save Lord Voldemort himself. A beautiful and deadly sorceress, absolutely loyal to her master. She had been, if such a thing were possible, more sadistic and evil even than you know who, as though she were trying to outdo her master. That was what the world knew of her, what the world believed of her. But before then, Professor Quirrell had told Harry, before the debut of the Dark Lord's most terrible servant, there had been a girl in Slytherin who had been quiet, keeping mostly to herself, harming no one. Afterward, there had been made-up stories told about her. Memories changing in retrospect. Harry knew well the research on that. But at the time, while she still attended school, the most talented witch in Hogwarts had been known as a gentle girl, Professor Quirrell had said. Her few friends had been surprised when she'd joined the Death Eaters, and more surprised that she'd been hiding so much darkness behind that sad, wistful smile. That was who Bellatrix had once been, the most promising witch of her own generation, before the Dark Lord stole her and broke her, shattered her and reshaped her, binding her to him on a deeper level and with darker arts than any Imperius. 10 years Bellatrix had served the Dark Lord, killing who he bade her kill, torturing who he bade her torture. And then the Dark Lord had finally been defeated, and Bellatrix's nightmare had continued. Somewhere inside Bellatrix, there might be something that was still screaming, that had been screaming the whole time. Something a psychiatric healer could bring back. Or there might not be. Professor Quirrell had no way of knowing. But either way, they could at least get her out of Azkaban. Bellatrix Black had been put into the lowest level of Azkaban. Harry was having trouble not imagining what he would see when they got to her cell. Bellatrix must have had almost no fear of death in the beginning, if she was still alive at all. They descended another flight of stairs, coming that much closer to death and Bellatrix, the clacking of their invisible shoes the only sound that Harry could hear. Dim orange light coming from the gaslights, the faint green spark drifting through the air, the shining figure following with its silver light fluctuating from time to time. After descending many times, they came in time to a corridor that did not end in stairs, and a final metal door, and the green spark halted before it. Harry's heart had calmed a little as they descended far into the depths of Azkaban without anything happening, but now it was hammering his chest once more. They were at the bottom, and the shadows of death were very close at hand. A soft metal click came from the lock as Professor Quirrell opened the way. Harry took a deep breath and remembered everything that Professor Quirrell had told him. The hard part wouldn't just be getting the pretend personality right enough to fool Bellatrix Black herself. The hard part would be keeping his Patronus going at the same time. The green spark winked out, and a moment later, a meter-high snake shimmered into existence, no longer invisible. The metal door moved with a slow, creaking sound as Harry pushed on it with his invisible hand, opened it just a crack, and peered through. He saw a straight corridor that terminated in solid stone. There was no light there but what crept in from Harry's Patronus. That was bright enough for him to see the outer bars of the 8 cells set into the corridor. But he couldn't see the insides. More importantly, though, he didn't see anyone in the corridor itself.
"I see nothing," hissed Harry.
The snake darted on ahead, swiftly twisting across the floor. A moment later,
"She is alone,"
hissed the snake.
"Stay,"
Harry thought to his Patronus, which took up a position just to one side of the door, as though guarding it, and then Harry pushed the door open further and followed within. The first cell Harry looked at contained a desiccated corpse, skin gone grey and mottled, flesh worn through in places to expose the bone beneath. No eyes. Harry shut his eyes. He could still do that. He was still invisible. He wasn't betraying anything by shutting his eyes. He'd known it already. He'd read it on page 6 of his Transfiguration book that you stayed in Azkaban until your prison term was done. If you died before it was up, they kept you there until they released your corpse. If your term was for life, they just left the body in the cell until the cell was needed, at which point they threw your body into the Dementor's pit. But it was still a shock to see. That corpse had been a person who'd just been left there. The light in the room wavered.
"Steady,"
thought Harry in his core. It wouldn't be good for Professor Quirrell if that Patronus went out from his thinking sad thoughts. This near to the Dementors, the defense professor might just fall dead where he stood.
"Steady, Harry James Potter Evans Ferris. Steady."
With that thought, Harry opened his eyes again. There wasn't time to waste. The second cell he looked at contained only a skeleton. And behind the bars of the third cell, he saw Bellatrix Black. Something precious and irreplaceable inside Harry withered like dry grass. You could tell the woman wasn't a skeleton, that her head wasn't a skull, because the texture of skin was still different from the texture of bone, no matter how white and pale she'd become, waiting in the dark alone. Either they weren't feeding her much, or what she ate, the shadow of death drained from her, for her eyes seemed shrunken below their lids. Her lips looked too shriveled to close over her teeth. The colour seemed leached out of the black clothing she had worn into prison, like the Dementors had drained that too. They'd been meant to be daring, those clothes, and now they lay loosely over a skeleton, exposing shriveled skin.
"I'm here to save her. I'm here to save her. I'm here to save her,"
Harry thought to himself, desperately, over and over, with an effort like occlumency, willing his Patronus not to go out, to stay and protect Bellatrix from the Dementors. In his heart, in his core, Harry held to all his pity and his compassion, his will to save her from the darkness. The silver radiance coming in through the open door brightened, even as he thought it. And in another part of him, like he was just letting another part of his mind carry out a habit without paying much attention to it, a cold expression came over Harry's face, invisibly beneath the hood.
"Hello, my dear Bella," said a chill whisper. "Did you miss me?"
Chapter 53. The Stanford Prison Experiment, Part 3. The corpse of a woman opened her eyes, and the dull, sunken orbs gazed out at nothing.
"Mad?"
Bellatrix muttered in a cracked voice.
"It seems that little Bella's going mad."
Professor Quirrell had instructed Harry, calmly and precisely, how he was to act in Bellatrix's presence, how to form the pretense he would maintain in his mind.
"You found it expedient, or perhaps just amusing, to make Bellatrix fall in love with you, to bind her to your service."
That love would have persisted through Azkaban, Professor Quirrell had said, because to Bellatrix it would not be a happy thought.
"She loves you utterly, completely, with her whole being. You do not return her love, but consider her useful. She knows this. She was the deadliest weapon you possessed, and you called her your dear Bella."
Harry remembered it from the night the Dark Lord killed his parents, the cold amusement, the contemptuous laughter, that high-pitched voice of deathly hate. It didn't seem at all difficult to guess what the Dark Lord would say.
"I hope you're not mad, Bella dear," said the chill whisper. "Mad is not useful."
Bellatrix's eyes flickered, tried to focus on empty air.
"My lord, I waited for you, but you did not come. I looked for you, but I could not find you. You are alive?"
All her words came out in a low mutter. If there was emotion in it, Harry could not tell.
"Show her your face," hissed the snake at Harry's feet.
Harry cast back the hood of the Cloak of Invisibility. The part of him that Harry had placed in control of his facial expressions looked at Bella without the slightest trace of pity, only cool, calm interest. While, in his core, Harry thought,
"I will save you. I will save you, no matter what."
"The scar,"
muttered Bellatrix.
"That child."
"So they all still think," said Harry's voice, and gave a thin little chuckle. "You looked for me in the wrong place, Bella dear."
Harry had asked why Professor Quirrell couldn't be the one to play the part of the Dark Lord, and Professor Quirrell had pointed out that there was no plausible reason for him to be possessed by the shade of he who must not be named. Bellatrix's eyes remained fixed on Harry. She said no word.
"Say something in parcel tongue," hissed the snake.
Harry's face turned to the snake to make it clear that he was addressing it, and hissed,
"One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten."
There was a pause.
"Those who do not fear the darkness,"
murmured Bellatrix. The snake hissed,
"will be consumed by it."
"Will be consumed by it,"
whispered the chill voice. Harry didn't particularly want to think about how Professor Quirrell had gotten that password. His brain, which thought about it anyway, suggested that it had probably involved a Death Eater, a quiet, isolated place, and some lead pipe legilimency.
"Your wand,"
murmured Bellatrix.
"I took it from the potter's house and hid it, my lord, under the tombstone to the right of your father's grave. Will you kill me now, if that was all you wished of me? I think I must have always wanted you to be the one to kill me, but I can't remember now. It must have been a happy thought."
Harry's heart wrenched inside him. It was unbearable, and he couldn't cry, couldn't let his Patronus fade. Harry's face showed a flicker of annoyance, and his voice was sharp as it said,
"Enough foolishness! You're to come with me, Bella dear, unless you prefer the company of the Dementors."
Bellatrix's face twitched in brief puzzlement. The shrunken limbs did not stir.
"You'll need to float her out,"
Harry hissed to the snake.
"She can no longer think of escaping."
"Yes," hissed the snake, "but do not underestimate her. She was the deadliest of warriors."
The green head dipped in warning.
"One would be wise to fear me, boy, even were I starved and nine-tenths dead. Be wary of her. Allow no single flaw in your pretense."
The green snake smoothly glided out the door, and shortly after, a man with sallow skin and a fearful expression on his bearded face cringed into the room with his wand in hand.
"My lord,"
the servant said falteringly.
"Do as you were instructed,"
the Dark Lord whispered in that chill voice, sounding even more terrible coming from a child's body.
"And do not let your Patronus falter. Remember, if I do not return, there will be no reward for you, and it will be long before your family is allowed to die."
Having spoken those dreadful words, the Dark Lord pulled his invisibility cloak over his head and disappeared. The cringing servant opened the door to Bellatrix's cage and pulled a tiny needle from his robes with which he poked the human skeleton. The single drop of red blood produced was soon absorbed into a small doll, which was laid upon the floor, and the servant began to chant in a whisper. Soon, another living skeleton lay upon the floor, motionless. Afterward, The servant seemed to hesitate for a moment, until from the empty air hissed an impatient command. Then the servant pointed his wand at Bellatrix and spoke a word, and the living skeleton lying on the bed was naked, and the skeleton lying on the floor was clothed in her faded dress. The servant tore a small strip of cloth from the dress as it lay upon the seeming corpse, and from his own robes the fearful man then produced an empty flask with small traces of golden fluid clinging to its inside. This flask was concealed in a corner, the strip of skirt laid over it, the leached cloth nearly blending with the grey metal wall. Another wave of the servant's wand floated the human skeleton lying on the bed into the air, and in almost the same motion clothed her in new black robes. An ordinary-looking bottle of chocolate milk was put into her hand, and a chill whisper ordered Bellatrix to grasp the bottle and begin drinking it, which she did, her face still looking only puzzled. Then the servant turned Bellatrix invisible and turned himself invisible, and they left. The door closed behind them all and clicked as it locked, plunging the corridor into darkness once more, unchanging but for a small flask concealed in the corner of one cell, and a fresh corpse lying upon its floor. Earlier, in the deserted shop, Professor Quirrell had told Harry that they were going to commit the perfect crime. Harry had unthinkingly started to repeat back the standard proverb that there was no such thing as a perfect crime, before he actually thought about it for 2/3 of a second, remembered a wiser proverb, and shut his mouth in mid-sentence.
"What do you think you know, and how do you think you know it?"
If you did commit the perfect crime, nobody would ever find out. So, how could anyone possibly know that there weren't perfect crimes? And as soon as you looked at it that way, you realized that perfect crimes probably got committed all the time, and the coroner marked it down as death by natural causes, or the newspaper reported that the shop had never been very profitable and had finally gone out of business. When Bellatrix Black's corpse was found dead in her cell the next morning, there within the prison of Azkaban from which, everyone knew, no one had ever escaped, nobody bothered doing an autopsy. Nobody thought twice about it. They just locked up the corridor and left. And the Daily Prophet reported it in the obituary column the next day. That was the perfect crime which Professor Quirrell had planned. And it wasn't Professor Quirrell who screwed it up. Chapter 54. The Stanford Prison Experiment, Part 4. A faint green spark moved forward to set the pace, and behind it followed a brilliant silver figure, all other entities invisible. They had traversed 5 legs of corridor, turned right 5 times, and gone up 5 flights of stairs, and when Bellatrix had finished her 2nd bottle of chocolate milk, she had been given solid bars of chocolate to eat. It was after her 3rd bar of chocolate that strange noises began to come from Bellatrix's throat. It took a moment for Harry to understand, to process the sounds. It didn't sound like anything he'd ever heard before. The rhythm of it was shattered, almost unrecognizable. It took him that long to realize that Bellatrix Black was crying. The Dark Lord's most terrible weapon was crying. She was invisible, but you could hear it. tiny, pathetic sounds she was trying to suppress, even now.
"It's real,"
said Bellatrix. Tonality had returned into her voice, no longer a dead mutter. It rose up at the end to form the question.
"It's real?"
"Yes,"
thought the part of Harry simulating the Dark Lord.
"Now be silent."
He couldn't make those words pass his lips. He just couldn't.
"I knew you would come to me some day."
Bellatrix's voice quavered and fractured as she drew breath for quiet sobs.
"I knew you were alive, that you would come to me, my lord."
There was a long inhalation, like a huge gasp.
"That even when you came, you still wouldn't love me. Never. You would never love me back. That was why they couldn't take my love from me, even though I can't remember so many other things, though I don't know what I forgot, but I remember how much I love you, Lord."
There was a knife stabbing through Harry's heart. He'd never heard anything so terrible. He wanted to hunt down the Dark Lord and kill him just for this.
"Do you still have use for me, my lord?"
"No,"
hissed Harry's voice without him even thinking. It just seemed to be operating on automatic.
"I entered Azkaban on a whim. Of course I have use for you. Don't ask foolish questions."
"But I'm weak,"
said Bellatrix's voice, and a full sob escaped her. It sounded much too loud in the corridors of Azkaban.
"I can't kill for you, my lord. I'm sorry. They ate it all. Ate me all up. I'm too weak to fight. What good am I to you now?"
Harry's brain cast about desperately for some way to reassure her, from the lips of a Dark Lord who would never speak a single word of caring.
"Ugly,"
said Bellatrix. Her voice said that word like it was the final nail in her coffin, the last despair.
"I'm ugly. They ate that, too. I'm not pretty anymore. You won't even be able to use me as a reward for your servants. Even the Lestranges won't want to hurt me anymore."
The brilliant silver figure stopped walking. Because Harry had stopped walking.
"The Dark Lord. He..."
The part of Harry's self that was soft and vulnerable was screaming in disbelieving horror, trying to reject reality, refuse the understanding, even as a colder and harder part completed the pattern.
"She obeyed him in that, as she obeyed him in all things."
The green spark bobbed urgently, darted forward. The silver humanoid stayed in place. Bellatrix was sobbing harder.
I'm not. I can't be useful anymore.
Giant hands were squeezing Harry's chest, wringing him like a washcloth, trying to crush his heart.
"Please," whispered Bellatrix. "Just kill me."
Her voice seemed to calm when she said that.
"Please, Lord, kill me. I've no reason to live if I'm no use to you. I only wanted to stop. Please hurt me one last time, my Lord. Hurt me until I stop. I love you."
It was the saddest thing Harry had ever heard. The bright silver shape of Harry's Patronus flickered, wavered, brightened. The fury that was rising in Harry, his rage against the Dark Lord who had done this, the rage against the Dementors, against Azkaban, against the world that allowed such horror, it all seemed to be pouring straight through his arm and into his wand without there being any way of blocking it. He tried willing it to stop, and nothing happened.
"My lord," whispered the disguised voice of Professor Quirrell, "my spell is going out of control. Help me, my lord."
Brighter the Patronus, brighter and brighter. It was waxing faster than on the day that Harry had destroyed a Dementor.
"My lord,"
the silhouette said in a terrified whisper.
"Help me! Everyone will feel it, my lord! Everyone will feel it," thought Harry.
His imagination could picture it clearly. The prisoners in their cells stirring as the cold and darkness fell away, replaced by healing light. Every exposed surface now burned like a white sun in the reflections, the silhouette of Bellatrix's skeleton and the sallow man now clearly visible in the blaze, the disillusionment spells unable to keep pace with the unearthly brilliance. Only the cloak of invisibility out of the deathly hallows withstood it.
"My lord, you must stop it!"
But Harry could no longer will it to stop. He no longer wanted it to stop. He could sense it. More and more of the sparks of life in Azkaban being sheltered by his Patronus. As it unfolded like spreading wings of sunlight, the air turned to absolute silver as he thought it. Harry knew what he had to do.
"Blaze! My lord!"
The words went unheard. They were far from him, the Dementors in their pit. But Harry knew that they could be destroyed, even at this distance, if the light blazed bright enough. He knew that death itself could not face him if he stopped holding back. So he unsealed all the gates inside him and sank the wells of his spell into all the deepest parts of his spirit, all his mind, and all his will, and gave over absolutely everything to the spell. And in the interior of the sun, an only slightly dimmer shadow moved forward, reaching out an entreating hand.
"Wrong, don't."
The sudden sense of doom clashed with Harry's steel determination. Dread and uncertainty stirring against the bright purpose. Nothing else might have reached him but that. The silhouette took another step forward. And another. The sense of doom rising to a point of terrible catastrophe, and in the drench of cold water, Harry saw it. He realized the consequences of what he was doing. The danger and the trap. If you'd been watching from outside, you'd have seen the interior of the sun brightening and dimming. Brightening and dimming. And finally, fading. Fading. Fading into ordinary moonlight that seemed like pitch darkness by contrast. Within the darkness of that moonlight stood a sallow man with his hand outstretched in entreaty, and the skeleton of a woman, lying upon the floor, a puzzled look on her face. And Harry, still invisible, fallen to his knees. The great danger had passed, and now Harry was just trying not to collapse, to keep the spell going at the lower level. He'd drained something, hopefully not lost something. He should have known. He should have remembered that it wasn't mere magic that fueled the Patronus charm.
"Thank you, my lord," whispered the sallow man.
"Fool," said the hard voice of a boy pretending to be a dark lord.
"Did I not warn you that the spell could prove fatal if you failed to control your emotions?"
Professor Quirrell's eyes did not widen, of course.
"Yes, my lord, I understand,"
said the Dark Lord's servant in a faltering voice, and turned to Bellatrix. She was already pushing herself off the floor, slowly, like an old, old Muggle woman.
"How funny,"
Bellatrix whispered.
"You were almost killed by a Patronus charm."
A giggle that sounded like it was blowing dust out of her giggle pipes.
"I could punish you, maybe, if my lord froze you in place and I had knives. Maybe I can be useful after all. Oh, I feel a little better now. How strange."
"Be silent, dear Bella,"
Harry said in a chill voice,
"until I give you leave to speak."
There was no reply, which was obedience. The servant levitated the human skeleton and made her invisible once more, followed shortly by his own disappearance with the sound of another cracking egg. They passed on through the corridors of Azkaban, and Harry knew that as they passed, the prisoners were stirring in their cells as the fear lifted for one precious moment, maybe even feeling a small touch of healing as his light passed them by, and then collapsing down again as the cold and darkness pressed back in. Harry was trying very hard not to think about it. Otherwise, his Patronus would wax until it burned away every Dementor in Azkaban, blazing bright enough to destroy them, even at this distance. Otherwise, his Patronus would wax until it burned away every Dementor in Azkaban, taking all of Harry's life as fuel. In the Aura's quarters, at the top of Azkaban, one Aura trio was snoring in the barracks. One Aura trio was resting in the break room, and one Aura trio was on duty in the command room, keeping their watch. The command room was simple but large, with three chairs at the back where the Auras sat, their wands always in hand to sustain their three Patronuses, as the bright white forms paced in front of the open window, sheltering them all from the Dementor's fear. The three of them usually stuck to the back and played poker, and didn't look out the window. You could have seen some sky there, sure, and there was even an hour or two every day where you could have seen some sun, But that window also looked down on the central pit of hell. Just in case a Dementor wanted to float up and talk to you. There was no way that Aura Lee would have agreed to serve duty here, triple pay or no triple pay, if he hadn't had a family to support. His real name was Xiao Guang, and everyone called him Mike instead. He'd named his children Su and Cao, which hopefully would serve them better. His only consolation, besides the money, was that at least his mates played an excellent game of dragon poker, though it would be hard not to at this point. It was their 5,366th game, and Lee had what would probably be his best hand of the 5,300s. It was a Saturday in February, and there were three players, which let him shift the suit of any one hole card except a 2, 3, or 7, and that was enough to let him build a corpse, with unicorns, dragons, and sevens. Across the table from him, Gerard McCuster looked up from the table cards toward the direction of the window, staring. The sinking feeling came over Lee's stomach with surprising speed. If his 7 of hearts got hit by a Dementor modifier and turned into a 6, he was going straight down to 2 pair, and McCuster might beat that.
"Mike," said McCuster, "what's with your Patronus?"
Lee turned his head and looked. His soft silver badger had turned away from its watch over the pit and was staring downward at something only it could see. A moment later, Bari's moonlit duck and McCuster's bright anteater followed suit, staring in the same downward direction. They all exchanged glances and then sighed.
"I'll tell them," said Bari.
Protocol called for sending the 3 Auras who were off duty but not sleeping to investigate anything anomalous.
"Maybe relieve one of them, and take the sea spiral, if you two don't mind."
Lee exchanged a glance with McCuster, and they both nodded. It wasn't too hard to break into Azkaban, if you were wealthy enough to hire a powerful wizard and well-intentioned enough to recruit someone who could cast the Patronus charm. People with friends in Azkaban would do that. Break in, just to give someone a half day's worth of Patronus time. A chance at some real dreams instead of nightmares. Leave them a supply of chocolate to conceal in their cell, to increase the chance they lived through their sentence. And the Auras on guard? Well, even if you got caught, you could probably convince the Auras to overlook it, in exchange for the right bribe. For Lee, the right bribe tended to be in the range of 2 knuts and a silver sickle. He hated this place. But Barry Onehand had a wife, and the wife had healer's bills, and if you could afford to hire someone who could break into Azkaban, then you could afford to grease Barry's remaining palm pretty hard if he was the one who caught you. By unspoken agreement, none of them giving anything away by being the first to propose it, the 3 of them finished out their poker hand first. Lee won, since no Dementors had actually shown up, and by then the Patronuses had stopped staring and gone back to their normal patrol, so it was probably nothing. But procedure was procedure. After Lee raked in the pot, Barry gave them all formal nods and stood up from the table. The older man's long white locks brushed against his fancy red robes. His robes brushed the metal floor of the command room as Barry went through the separating door that led to the formerly off-duty Auras. Lee had been sorted into Hufflepuff, and he sometimes felt a little queasy about this kind of business. But Barry had shown them all the pictures, and you had to let a man do what he could for his poor, sick wife. especially when he only had 7 months left before his retirement. The faint green spark floated through the metal corridors, and the silver humanoid, seeming a little dimmer now, followed after it. Sometimes the bright figure would flare, especially when they passed one of the huge metal doors, but it always died back down again. Mere eyes could not have seen the invisible others, the 11-year-old boy who lived, and the living skeleton that was Bellatrix Black, and the polyjuiced defense professor of Hogwarts, all traveling together through Azkaban. If that was the beginning of a joke, Harry didn't know the punchline. They'd gone up another 4 flights of stairs before the rough voice of the defense professor said simply, and without emphasis,
"Aura coming."
It took too long, a whole second maybe, for Harry to understand, for the jolt of adrenaline to pump into his blood, and for him to remember what Professor Quirrell had already discussed with him and told him to do in this case. And then Harry spun on his heel and flew back the way they'd come. Harry reached the flight of stairs and frantically laid himself down on the 3rd step from the top, the cold metal feeling hard even through his cloak and robes. Trying to move his head up, to peer over the lip of the steps, showed that he couldn't see Professor Quirrell, and that meant that Harry was out of the line of any stray fire. His shining Patronus followed after him, and lay down beside him on the step just beneath him, for it too must not be seen. There was a faint sound, as of wind or whooshing, and then the sound of Bellatrix's invisible body coming to rest on a stair further below. She had no place in this except...
"Stay still,"
said the cold high whisper.
"Stay silent."
There was stillness and silence. Harry pressed his wand against the side of the metal step just above him. If he was anyone else, he would have needed to take a knut out of his pocket, or rip off a bit of cloth from his robe, or bite off one of his nails, or find a speck of rock large enough that he could see it and solid enough to stay in one place and orientation while it touched his wand. But, with Harry's almighty power of partial transfiguration, this was not necessary. He could skip that particular step of the operation and use any material near to hand. 30 seconds later, Harry was the proud new owner of a curved mirror and...
"Wingardium Leviosa,"
Harry whispered as quietly as he could, was levitating it just above the steps and watching, in that curved surface, almost the whole corridor where Professor Quirrell invisibly waited. Harry heard it in the distance then, the sound of footsteps, and saw the form, a little hard to see in the mirror, of a person in red robes, coming down the stairs, entering the seemingly empty corridor, accompanied by a small Patronus animal that Harry couldn't quite make out. The aura was protected by a blue shimmer. It was hard to see the details, but Harry could see that much. The aura had shields already raised and strengthened.
"Crap,"
thought Harry. According to the defense professor, the essential art of dueling consisted of trying to put up defenses that would block whatever someone was likely to throw at you, while trying, in turn, to attack in ways that were likely to go past their current set of defenses. And, by far, the easiest way to win any sort of real fight, Professor Quirrell had said this over and over, was to shoot the enemy before they raised a shield in the first place, either from behind or from close enough range that they couldn't dodge or counter in time. Though Professor Quirrell might still be able to get in a shot from behind if... But the aura halted after taking 3 steps into the corridor.
"Nice disillusionment,"
said a hard male voice that Harry didn't recognize.
"Now show yourself, or you'll be in real trouble."
The form of the sallow, bearded man became visible then.
"And you, with the Patronus," said the hard voice. "Come out, too. Now."
"Wouldn't be smart," said the gravelly voice of the sallow man.
It was no longer the terrified voice of the Dark Lord's servant. It had suddenly become the professional intimidation of a competent criminal.
"You don't want to see who's behind me. Trust me, you don't. 500 galleons, cold cash up front, if you turn around and walk away. Big trouble for your career if you don't."
There was a long pause.
"Look, whoever you are," said the hard voice, "you seem confused about how this works. I don't care if that's Lucius Malfoy behind you or Albus Bloody Dumbledore. You all come out. I scanned a whole lot of you. And then we talk about how much this is going to cost you."
2,000 galleons. Final offer," said the gravelly voice, taking on a warning undertone. "That's 10 times the going rate and more than you make in a year. And believe me, if you see something you shouldn't, you're gonna regret not taking that."
"Shut it," said the hard voice. "You've got exactly 5 seconds to drop that wand before I drop you. 5, 4.
"What are you doing, Professor Quirrell?"
Harry thought frantically.
"Attack first. Cast a shield at least.
3, 2, 1. Stupefy."
Barry stared, a chill running down his spine. The man's wand had moved so fast that it was like it had apparated into place, and Barry's stunner was currently sparkling tamely at the end of it. Not blocked, not countered, not deflected. Caught, like a fly in honey.
"My offer has gone back down to 500 galleons," said the man in a colder, more formal voice.
He smiled dryly, and the smile looked wrong on that bearded face.
"And you shall need to accept a memory charm."
Barry had already swapped the harmonics on his shield so that his own stunner couldn't pass back through, already tilted his wand back into a defensive position, already raised his hardened artificial hand into position to block anything blockable, and was already thinking wordless spells to put more layers on his shields. The man wasn't looking at Barry. Instead, he was poking curiously at Barry's stunner, where it still wavered on the end of his wand, drawing out red sparks and flicking them away with his fingers, slowly disassembling the hex like a child's rod puzzle. The man hadn't raised any shields of his own.
"Tell me,"
the man said in a disinterested voice that didn't seem to quite fit the rough throat. Polyjuice, Barry would have called it, if he thought that anyone could possibly do magic that delicate from inside someone else's body.
"What did you do in the last war? Put yourself in harm's way, or stay out of trouble?"
"Harm's way," said Barry.
His voice kept the iron calm of an aura with nearly 100 full years on the force, 7 months short of mandatory retirement. Mad-Eye Moody couldn't have said it with more hardness.
"Fight any Death Eaters?"
Now a grim smile graced Barry's own face.
"Do at once."
2 of you-know-who's own warrior assassins, personally trained by their dark master. 2 Death Eaters at once, against Barry alone. It had been the toughest fight of Barry's life, but he stood his ground and walked away with only the loss of his left hand.
"Did you kill him?"
The man sounded idly curious, and he continued to draw threads of fire out of the much-diminished stun bolt, still captive on the end of his wand. His fingers now weaving small patterns of Bari's own magic before flicking to disperse them. Sweat broke out on Bari's skin beneath his robes. His metal hand flashed downward, ripped the mirror from his belt.
"Bari to Mike, I need backup!"
There was a pause, and silence.
"Bari to Mike!"
The mirror lay dull and lifeless in his hand. Slowly, Bari put it back on his belt.
"It's been quite a while since I had a serious fight with a serious opponent," the man said, still not looking up at Bari. "Try not to disappoint me too much. You can attack whenever you're ready, or you can walk away with 500 galleons."
There was a long silence. Then the air screamed like metal cutting glass as Bari slashed his wand downward. Harry could hardly see it, could hardly make out anything amid the lights and flashes. His mirror's curve was perfect. They'd practiced this tactic before in the Chaos Legion, but the scene was still too small, and Harry had the feeling he wouldn't be able to understand even if he was watching from a meter away. It was all happening too fast. Red blasts deflecting from blue shields, green bars of light clashing together, shadowy forms appearing and vanishing. He couldn't even tell who was casting what, except that the aura was shouting incantation after incantation and frantically dodging while Professor Quirrell's polyjuiced form stood in one place and flicked his wand. Mostly silently, but now and then producing words in unrecognizable languages that would white out the whole mirror and show half the aura's shielding being torn away as he staggered back. Harry had seen exhibition duels between the strongest seventh-year students, and this was so far above it that Harry's mind felt numb, looking at how far he had left to go. There wasn't a single seventh-year student who could have lasted half a minute against the aura. All three seventh-year armies put together might not be able to scratch the defense professor. The aura had fallen to the ground, one knee and one hand supporting himself as the other hand gestured frantically and his mouth shouted desperate words. The few incantations that Harry recognized were all shield spells, as a flock of shadows spun around the aura like a whirlwind of razors. And Harry saw Professor Quirrell's polyjuiced form deliberately point his wand at where the aura kneeled and fought the last moments of his battle.
"Surrender!" said the gravelly voice.
The aura spat something unspeakable.
"In that case," said the voice, "Avada!"
Time seemed to move very slowly, like there was time to hear the individual syllables, ke and da and vra. Time to watch the aura starting to throw himself desperately aside, and even though it was all happening so slowly, somehow there wasn't time to do anything. No time for Harry to open his lips and scream, "No!" No time to move. Maybe even not any time to think. Only time for one desperate wish that an innocent man should not die. And a blazing silver figure stood before the aura. Stood there. Just a fraction of a second before the green light struck home. Bari was twisting frantically aside, not knowing if he was going to make it. His eyes were focused on his opponent and his onrushing death, so Bari only briefly saw the outline of the brilliant silhouette, the Patronus brighter than any he'd ever seen. saw it just barely long enough to recognize the impossible shape before the green and silver light collided and both lights vanished. Both lights vanished. The killing curse had been blocked. And then Bari's ears were pierced as he saw his terrible opponent screaming. Screaming, screaming, clutching at his head and screaming, starting to fall as Bari was already falling. Bari hit the ground, falling from his own frantic lunge, and his dislocated left shoulder and broken rib screamed in protest. Bari ignored the pain, managed to scramble back to his knees, brought up his wand to stun his opponent. He didn't understand what was happening, but he knew that this was his only chance.
Stupefy!
The red bolt struck out toward the man's falling body and was torn apart in midair and dissipated, and not by any shield. Bari could see it, the wavering in the air that surrounded his fallen and screaming opponent. Bari could feel it, like a deadly pressure on his skin, the flux of magic building and building and building toward some terrible breaking point. His instincts screamed at him to run before the explosion came. This was no charm, no curse. This was wizardry, run wild. But before Bari could even finish getting to his feet, the man threw his wand away from himself. He threw away his wand, and a second later his form blurred and vanished entirely. A green snake lay motionless on the ground, unmoving, even before Bari's next stunner spell fired in sheer reflex, hitting it without resistance. As the dreadful flux and pressure began to dissipate, as the wild wizardry died back down, Bari's dazed mind noticed that the scream was continuing, only it sounded different, like the scream of a young boy, coming from the stairs leading down to the next lower level. That scream choked off too, and then there was silence, except for Bari's frantic panting. His thoughts were slow, confused, disarrayed. His opponent had been insanely powerful. That hadn't been a duel. It had been like his first year as a trainee aura trying to fight Madame Tamara. The Death Eaters hadn't been a tenth that good. Mad-Eye Moody wasn't that good. And who? What? How in the name of Merlin's balls had anyone blocked a killing curse? Bari managed to summon the energy to press his wand against his rib, muttering the healing spell, and then press it again to his shoulder. It took more out of him than it should have. Took far too much out of him. His magic was within a bare breath of its utter exhaustion. He didn't have anything left for his minor cuts and bruises, or even to reinforce the scraps left of his shielding. It was all he could do not to let his Patronus go out. Bari breathed deeply, heavily, steadied his breath as much as he could before he spoke.
"You," Bari said, "whoever you are, come out."
There was silence, and it occurred to Bari that whoever it was might be unconscious. He didn't understand what had just happened, but he had heard the scream. Well, there was one way to test that.
"Come out," said Bari, making his voice harder, "or I start using area effect curses."
He probably couldn't have managed one if he'd tried.
"Wait,"
said a boy's voice, a young boy's voice, high and thin and wavering, like someone was holding back exhaustion or tears. The voice now seemed to be coming from closer to hand.
"Please wait. I'm coming out."
"Drop the invisibility,"
growled Barry. He was too tired to bother with anti-disillusionment charms. A moment later, a young boy's face emerged from within an unfolding invisibility cloak, and Barry saw the black hair, the green eyes, the glasses, and the angry red lightning bolt scar. If he had 20 fewer years of experience under his belt, he might have blinked. Instead, he just spat something that he probably shouldn't ought to say in front of the boy who lived. The boy's wavering voice said, his young face looking frightened and exhausted, and tears were still trickling down his cheeks.
He kidnapped me, to make me cast my Patronus. He said he'd kill me if I didn't, only I couldn't let him just kill you.
Barry's mind was still dazed, but things were slowly starting to click into place. Harry Potter, the only wizard ever to survive a killing curse. Barry might have been able to dodge the Green Death. He'd certainly been trying. But if the matter came up before the Wizengamot, they'd rule it was a life debt to a noble house.
I see, Barry said in a much gentler growl. He started to walk toward the boy. Son, I'm sorry for what you've been through, but I need you to drop the cloak and drop your wand.
The rest of Harry Potter emerged from invisibility, showing the sweat-soaked, blue-trimmed Hogwarts robes, and his right hand clutching an 11-inch holly wand so hard his knuckles were white.
"Your wand?"
Barry repeated.
"Sorry,"
whispered the 11-year-old boy.
"Here."
And he held out the wand to Barry. Barry barely stopped himself from snarling at the traumatized boy who'd just saved his life. Instead, he overrode the impulse with a sigh and just stretched out a hand to take the wand.
"Look, son, you're really not supposed to point a wand at..."
The wand's end twisted lightly beneath Barry's hand just as the boy whispered,
"Somnium."
Harry stared at the aura's crumpled body. There was no sense of triumph, just a crushing sense of despair. Even then, it might not have been too late. Harry turned to look at where the green snake lay motionless.
"Teacher,"
hissed Harry.
"Friend, please, are you alive?"
An awful fear was taking hold in Harry's heart. In that moment, he had entirely forgotten that he'd just seen the defense professor try to kill a police officer. Harry pointed his wand at the snake, and his lips even began to shape the words,
"Innovate,"
before his brain caught up with him and screamed at him. He didn't dare use magic on Professor Quirrell. Harry had felt it. The burning, tearing pain in his head like his brain was about to split in half. He'd felt it. His magic and Professor Quirrell's magic matched and anti-harmonized in a fulfillment of doom. That was the mysterious, terrible thing that would happen if Harry and Professor Quirrell ever got too close to each other, or if they ever cast magic on each other. Or, if their spells ever touched, their magic would resonate out of control. Harry stared at the snake. He couldn't tell if it was breathing. The last seconds ticked away. He turned to stare at the aura, who had seen the boy who lived, who knew. The full magnitude of the disaster crushed in on Harry like 1,000 hundred-ton weights. He had managed to stun the aura,
But now, there was nothing left to do. No way to recover. The mission had failed. Everything had failed. He had failed. Shocked, dismayed, despairing, he didn't think of it. Didn't see the obvious. Didn't remember where the hopeless feelings were coming from. Didn't realize that he still needed to recast the true Patronus charm. And then, it was already too late. Aura Lee and Aura McCuster had rearranged their chairs around the table, and so they both saw it at the same time. The naked, skeletally thin horror rising up to hover outside the window, the headache already hitting them from seeing it. They both heard the voice. Like a long dead corpse had spoken words, and those words themselves had aged and died. The Dementor's speech hurt their ears as it said,
"Bellatrix Black is out of herself."
There was a split second of horrified silence, and then Lee tore out of his chair, heading for the communicator to call in reinforcements from the Ministry, even as McCuster grabbed his mirror and started frantically trying to raise the three auras who'd gone on patrol. Chapter 55. The Stanford Prison Experiment, Part 5. In a scarred and ruined corridor, lit by dim gas lights, a boy slowly crept forward, one hand stretched out toward the unmoving snake that was the body of his teacher. Harry was only a meter away from the snake's body when he first felt it, tickling at the edge of his perception. Ever so weakly, a sense of doom. Professor Quirrell was alive then. The thought engendered no feeling of joy, only a sort of empty despair. Harry would still be caught soon, and no matter how he tried to explain, it still wouldn't look good. No one would trust him again. They would think he was the next Dark Lord. They wouldn't help him when it came to fight Lord Voldemort. Hermione would give up on him. Probably even Dumbledore would look for another hero. Maybe they'd just send him home to his parents. He had failed. Harry looked at the crumpled body of the police officer he had stunned. The already drying blood from the minor cuts and slashes, the burned places on the intricately embroidered red robes. He had been stupid. He shouldn't have stunned the police officer. Should have just stayed with his original story about being kidnapped by Professor Quirrell.
"It might not be too late," whispered a voice inside him. "You might still be able to fix your mistake. The Aura saw you. He remembers that you stunned him. But if he were dead, if Professor Quirrell were dead, if Bellatrix were dead, there would be no one to contradict your story."
Slowly, Harry's hand started to rise, pointing his wand at the police officer, and Harry's hand halted. He had a distant sense he was behaving uncharacteristically of himself, somehow. Like there was something he'd forgotten. Something important, but he was having trouble remembering what it was exactly. Ah, that was right. He was someone who believed in the value of human life. A sense of puzzlement accompanied the thought. He couldn't quite remember why other people's lives had seemed valuable.
"All right,"
said the logical part of him.
Why has my mind changed between then and now?
Because he was in Azkaban. And he had forgotten to recast the Patronus charm. Doing anything at all somehow seemed like a tremendous effort, like the thought of action itself was a weight too heavy to lift. But it did seem like a good idea to recast the Patronus charm, for he was still able to be afraid of Dementors. And though he couldn't remember what it was like to be happy, he knew that this wasn't it. Harry's hand rose to hold his wand level before him. His fingers took the starting positions. And then Harry paused. He couldn't quite remember what he'd used as his happy thought. That was odd. It had been something very important. He really ought to be able to remember it. Something to do with death? But that wasn't happy. His body was shivering. Azkaban hadn't seemed so cold before, and it seemed to be getting colder even as he thought. It was too late for him. He'd already sunk too far. He'd never be able to cast the Patronus charm now.
That may be the dementation talking rather than an accurate estimate,
observed the logical part of himself, habits that had been encoded into sheer reflex, requiring no energy to activate.
Think of the Dementor's fear as a cognitive bias, and try to overcome it the way you would overcome any other cognitive bias. Your hopeless feelings may not indicate that the situation is actually hopeless. It may only indicate that you are in the presence of Dementors. All negative emotions and pessimistic estimates